the fifth kind.
It's about 50 of my fingers will probably fit in there. It's a rough estimate. So this is 50 times larger than I am. So we're looking at about an 80 meter tall being. 80 meters. This is something unheard of, right? And right now, we cannot ask for a better time to contemplate and look inwards and contemplate our lives and what's actually going on. Do we want to go back to this broken world, a broken society that's a dog-eat-dog, where we have to work like slaves just to survive? Then there's an education system that's just fallen apart, that is shoving crap down our children's brains and throats, just indoctrination to create a future obedient labor force for the royal banking elite. And people are very rapidly waking up to this. And I think this lockdown phase has been a huge awakening and a wake-up call for people to realize and recognize the truth of what's going on, especially now.
If you would like to hear Michael Tellinger go deeper into these and more controversial topics, go to fifthkind.tv for uncensored access to the full 2 hours of this revealing interview.
Today we are in conversation with Michael Tellinger. Michael is an investigative researcher and founder of the Global Ubuntu Liberation Movement. His research exposes us to compelling new evidence of previous civilizations on planet Earth, and his findings challenge our very understanding of human origins. Now, I discovered this history, this prehistory, through studying the book of Genesis and doing some translation work in it. I did some work with the word Elohim and started reading those stories differently with that word in the plural. And I started recognizing the stories, and I realized this was a retelling of the Sumerian stories. So that was my way into this topic. How did you find out about the Mesopotamian narratives, the cuneiform tablets? How did you discover that? And was that all part of your knowledge base before you discovered the stone circles?
Yes, I'd known about the Sumerian tablets and Sumerian texts since I was about 30 years old. So that's when I discovered, actually I was 30 at the time, I discovered the writings of Zachariah Sitchin. And overnight, I just, you know, got stuck in his books, and I read all his books that were available at the time. And that opened my mind to a whole new history, and suddenly realizing that what we read as mythology and that is poo-pooed by mainstream academia is actually the real history of humankind and the real history of the world. And they keep trying to hide that and trying to lock it up and throw it away and discard it. But unfortunately, that hasn't worked. More and more people are waking up to this. And when you start looking at mythology, you also start seeing the connections between the mythological stories and the stories in the Bible. And you start realizing, oh my God, the stories in the Bible are a lot closer to the truth than I ever imagined. And you start seeing the connections between the stories of creation in the Sumerian texts, of the creation of Adam or the birth of Adam, and the creation of Eve in the Sumerian texts, when they say that Eve was, you know, Adam was first created and then they needed to procreate on their own. So they took his essence to create his female partner. This is the Sumerian texts. It's the same story as you find in the Bible, you know, taking Adam's rib and creating Eve.
Yeah. When you go to the Mesoamerican narrative, the Popol Vuh, the Mayan tradition, it says very unapologetically what you just said, where the visitors, the colonizers say, let us make avatars for ourselves to do the work for us and bring us our food. And that seems to be a key aspect. When we're talking about prehistoric mining, we know our ancestors, that people who were the same shape as us and build as us were here 200,000 years ago, not smart enough to build their own cities or to farm, but apparently smart enough to work in someone else's mine. And that's the picture that seems to be emerging. Something I forgot earlier, though, was again to do with the amazing properties of these structures. We've got something that can produce phenomenal energy, maybe sufficient to manipulate weather systems, maybe sufficient to power all the operations, transportation, mine, whatever the people were doing who were there at that time. But as you've toured around these, you've discovered And perhaps we shouldn't be surprised when we're looking at sonic vibrational energies that there's a healing power to what happens in these stone circles. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how you discovered that?
Yeah, that's, again, another wonderful, you know, unexpected discovery and a surprise that when it first surfaced in about 2010, people started to tell me that they experienced some sort of a healing while they were in the stone circles, whether it was a sore back or a sore knee or whatever, a headache or whatever it was, you know, muscle pain. And I kept getting this feedback from people that they, you know, before they went in, they had this pain and now it's gone. And I thought, okay, well, it's just a coincidence. And it just kept happening over and over again. And I, you know, you ignore it because you just, you know, it doesn't enter your reality. But at the time, I already knew that the stone circles were energy generators. So I should have paid more attention to it, but it did come later. But what is fascinating is that many of your listeners will know that sound heal all disease. I mean, 1931, Royal Raymond Dreyfus is probably the most famous healer and doctor and medical guy that actually cured people of full-blown cancer, literally at will. I mean, the stories of what he was doing with his sound frequencies in 1931 and before that and after that, I believe, until he got completely ruined by the American Medical Association and the big pharma companies. He was hailed as the guy that found the cure for all disease. In 1931, they held a banquet in his honor to give him an award and you know, call him the guy that found a cure for all disease. And this is not a small thing. And so once we realize, and again, in my lectures, I go into the details, I go into the science and the physics of this in as much detail as you want, because sometimes people don't want too much detail, but if they want, I'll take them right down to the quantum mechanics explanation of all this stuff. But ultimately, sound is the primordial source code for everything. When I say sound, I mean resonance and vibration that we experience in this density as sound. And so that is the primordial source code for everything. So if sound can manifest everything in our reality, in the universe, everything comes from sound and resonance. That means that we can do everything with sound. And again, in my lectures, you can go online and watch my YouTube videos. I go into detail what you can do with sound. And there is no end, no limit. One of them is obviously healing. You can heal all and cure all disease with sound and resonance and frequency. And that's in essence what's happening here. So whether you like, whether you know it or not, when you enter the stone circles, your body and the trillions of cells in your body are exposed to the frequencies that are emitted by the stone walls of the stone circles. Now, what frequencies are these stone circles emitting? They're emitting good frequencies because they're emitting natural earth frequencies, the frequencies that should be harmonizing with the cells and the organs in our bodies and our entire body. Keep in mind, our bodies are filled with trillions of cells, and those cells then have to vibrate together in sympathetic harmonic coherence. If they don't, if they're not in sympathetic vibration, they're in dissonance. If they're not in coherence, they're in dissonance or in dis-ease. And if they're in dis-ease, they're in disease and you get sick. So if our bodies and the trillions of cells in our bodies and the organs, if they're not vibrating in coherent harmonic resonance with everything else in our body, and then again, with the earth below our feet and the environment around us, then we're constantly in a state of dis-ease or dissonance. So now when you enter the stone circle, you're entering an environment that is amplifying, dramatically amplifying the natural frequencies of the earth. It's just pumping it into the air around you. So your trillions of cells in your bodies are automatically exposed to the good frequencies, the frequencies that the earth is pushing up, not cell phone towers or cell phones or laptops or all the other electronic crap that is destroying our cellular structure and killing us. So whether you like it or not, whatever disease you might have will start to repair itself because the cells in your body will start to align and become coherent with the earth and coherent with each other. Now, what's even more interesting, we have actually now discovered which stone circles have an effect on which part of your body. We now know that this stone circle is good for your liver and your kidneys, and this one is good for your heart. This one is good for your DNA. This one is good for your brain. That's how much research we've done. It is quite spectacular.
What's the most dramatic experience of healing that you can report?
Oh, that was actually the very first sacred sites tour that I did in 2014. A very wealthy couple from Vermont came out here. They were very, very reserved with the knowledge, with the information they shared about who they are and why they're here. We just know that they were very wealthy, and they came the first year, and then they came back again a year later on a second tour with me, and then in December 2016, when I went to Vermont to do a lecture on Ubuntu and One Small Town Contributionism, they came to meet me, to see me, and the woman especially came to see me and said they came especially to thank me for saving their life, saving her life. And I went, wow, what is it? What did I do? And she said, well, it was the stone circles in Adam's calendar and Great Zimbabwe, the energies in the stone circles that cured her from full-blown cancer. She was going to die. They came to South Africa on their last trip together, and she believed that when they got back to the USA, she only had like 6 months left to live. And when they got back, she went for a checkup, and the doctor said, what have you been doing? And she said, oh, we went to South Africa to visit some, you know, ancient sites. And he said, well, whatever you're doing, your cancer is receding dramatically, so do more of that. So that's why they came back the next year. And when she went back, her cancer was gone. So that is the most extreme form of healing that I've heard. Actual feedback where the people went out of their way to tell me about it.
I love how you describe that, because people might think of healing practices that involve tones, humming, chanting, gongs, musical bowls, all designed to immerse a person in a certain frequency, or even architecture is a person in a certain frequency. Having the planet itself hum over us so that we're in resonance with the planet that we live on. I think that's a beautiful way of describing it. There's another aspect I want to ask you about, because there are so many ways in which this research upsets our story of humanity and where we came from. When I went to school, the story I was told about human origins is that we evolved very gradually. There's a single line of progress that you can trace as we get more and more sophisticated to become us. That picture's really been very much complicated and somewhat blown out of the water in recent decades, because we've discovered that we have Neanderthal heritage. We've discovered the Denisovans. We've discovered the hobbits of Indonesia, Homo floresiensis. And of course, in the past, there was a spate of finds in the 19th century of giant hominids. And so the picture is really confused now, and it looks like there was a great deal more going on in the ancient history that produced us and others. And you've made some fossil finds in the area that speak into that whole subject. Could you tell us something about that?
Oh, absolutely. So in January 2018 was a real turning point that sent this research into a whole new direction that nobody could have expected, certainly not me, because that's when I realized that all these strange and weird tools and artifacts that I've been collecting, and especially the elongated stones, the stones that ring like bells, were not actually stones, but they're actually fossilized, petrified body parts. Humanoid, reptilian, who knows, possibly Anunnaki, who knows what other beings, but from creatures, small, look like little dinosaurs or little, you know, reptilian type of creatures, to very large creatures with huge teeth and huge body parts that some of them are too big for me to bring into the museum. And these lie scattered right across the mountains here. And that's when everything changed. And not only did everything change, it also scrambled the timeline. as to how things happened here and became even more confusing. And this is why I tell people, if you think you know the human history, just take the textbooks that you've read and throw them out of the window, because everything has been rewritten here. There's a whole history here that we know absolutely nothing about, an ancient history, and even a more recent history. This, it's not just ancient history. This stuff goes back in Southern Africa, goes back, you know, as far as 10,000 years. And that's not really that far back. 1,000 years ago, there were still Anunnaki mining gold here. That's how crazy it is. So in January 2018, I suddenly realized that the stones that I was walking on for 11 years were actually petrified body parts, and it was this stone here. Can you see that?
Wow.
It's this stone that did it. And once again, I said, why is this stone this weird shape? We were out in the up mountain with a group of people that were here on my research expedition program. And I picked the stone up and I said, why is this stone this weird shape? And I put it down on the wall there, one of the stone walls. When we come down this mountain, I will know what this is about. And lo and behold, as we came down half an hour later or so, I took one look at that stone, even from a distance, lying there on the stone wall that I put it for me to find on the way back. And even from a distance, I went, that's not a stone. That is a rib. And suddenly my life and everything changed. You can clearly see this is a petrified, fossilized rib. It's got that lovely curvature. And it gets thin towards the tip of the rib. This is mostly just bone right at the top here. There's hardly any muscle or meat on it. And over here, there's still some remaining muscle and meat on it. You can see it clearly at the back here. And at the bottom here, you can see how the rib gets wider where it age. You can clearly see where there were other ligaments and all the stuff that holds ribs into the rib cage. Some of the fatty and sinewy stuff is still attached to it, but it's all turned to stone. So we have a beautiful petrified rib of some creature, whether it was humanoid or animal, I don't know. But it is a beautiful example, and this has become one of the prime examples of these fossils. And right next to it was another rib. This is a slightly different rib. This is higher up. It's probably higher up the anatomy, the skeleton, whatever creature it was. We don't know. You can see there where it was attached to the rib cage or to whatever it was attached to. You see the bone going into it. You can see the meat on it, the muscle here. But the weirdest thing is actually this. Can you see those cuts there?
Yes.
Right. So somebody was eating this rib. Those are not erosion or accidental. Those are very, very distinct cuts. And somebody was very specifically eating this or cutting it, because these are too perfect to happen accidentally or via erosion. So somebody was busy eating the spare rib when it was covered or discarded. Somebody ate it and they had enough and they threw it away. And this rib then ended up in the mud when the flood came and turned to stone together with the other rib around it. So what I have in the museum hundreds and possibly more than 1,000 examples of fossilized petrified body parts of all kinds of creatures. We have hearts, we have teeth, we have fingers, we have jaw bones. There are skin and flesh body parts of reptilians with reptilian skin. Goodness, there's just so much. We have claws and claw marks. And here's a great example of a little leg. This is a leg of a little creature. Now, if you're walking up the mountain, you saw this lying there, it would just be a stone. But unfortunately now for me, I no longer see stones. I see body parts everywhere. If you take a close look at this, you realize this is a leg. It's a leg of some creature, and that broke off here. This could have been a knuckle or something down here. And where that broke off, you can see the claw marks there. There are two claw marks.
All right.
See those? Right.
Yes.
And right at the bottom here, where the bone marrow came out, over there, you can see those teeth marks or claw marks right there, getting to the bone marrow I don't know if you can see those.
Yes, it's gruesome.
Okay. I'm just giving you, we're just scratching the surface here. These claw marks and getting to the bone marrow, I have claw marks and scratch marks and bite marks on rocks and bones lying, covering the mountains here. Some of the claw marks or the teeth marks, we don't know if they were claws or fangs, you know, of creatures. Some of them are like, you know, more than half a meter long, that go into what used to be a piece of meat, and now it's just a big rock. So there's so much phenomenal new discovery.
Yes.
And the main thing is,
go on.
Pardon? Yeah.
This is
the main thing is that we
found.
Go ahead, Paul.
This is in the last 2 years that this has been found.
Yes, this is from January 2018. You spoke about the different size of beings and creatures. I'm going to share this with you because this is a way I always teach people that work in the spiritual or metaphysical realms or sciences or fields, and that they're often, you know, belittled by the self-appointed gurus in the mainstream sciences that always think they know better. Unfortunately, those are the guys with the pea brains, generally speaking. I'm sorry, I have to be rude because this is what I found over and over again. Unless they've stepped out of that box and they've opened themselves up to new knowledge and information, and then obviously they're part of the team. But generally speaking, the mainstream academia is very difficult to converse on this because they have to feed their families and they have to look after themselves, and they can't step out of the box, otherwise they lose their job. So they just toe the line and keep peddling the BS. So this is what you, if you are a spiritual worker or a channeler or a healer or a metaphysics teacher or whatever, this is a number one argument that you can use when you start having success rates with certain of your practices that you do. And that is called the argument of probability. And because, you know, people that work in the spiritual metaphysics realms don't necessarily understand the argument of probability, but the argument of probability is the most commonly used argument in science, physics, and mathematics, especially mathematics. And so once you have a probability factor that supports a certain thought process or a certain activity or a certain idea, then you have scientific proof that it is most likely so. And if the probability factor is very heavily swayed in your favor, then it is so, right? So here we have a stone. Can you see the stone?
Yep.
Now, in 2009, this stone was dug out while we were digging the foundations for the Stone Circle Museum, the new extension to it. And I remember it very well because of the color, the skin, the color of the stone. It's very different. And this came out with another bunch of stones that look similar color to this. And they ended up on a pile of rocks next to the driveway into Stone Circle Lodge in the museum. And just recently, after discovering the fossils, I was walking up the driveway when I saw the stone lying on the edge of the driveway. And I suddenly remembered, that stone, and it's still lying here. And it somehow found its way to lie on the edge of the driveway. So I picked it up and I looked at it and I went, oh my God, because now I had like a year or more experience in recognizing fossils. I picked it up and I looked at it very quickly and I went, oh my God, this is a finger. This is a tip of a finger of a being. Those little lines there are actually the arteries, the veins and the arteries under the nail, where the nail would have been. That's the bottom. You can see the bottom of that little lovely little pouch. If you look at your finger at the bottom, you see it's got that lovely curve. It's got that lovely curve at the bottom, exactly like that, right? And then at the back, you can see the bone. That's the bone sticking out there, coming out the finger. And this piece here is just the skin and the flesh. When this finger was severed, that the remaining skin and flesh just fell down and flopped over the bone that was cut off here. So, and it turned into stone. So now it looks a bit weird, but that's actually the skin and flesh that just covered that side of the. And then what happens when you cut a finger or something like that, Oh, you can see very clearly the fatty, the muscle and the tissue underneath there, just below the bone. It's nice and nice fatty tissue there, you see? The cushion effect of the bottom of the finger. So what happens when you sever a finger like that, all the blood would automatically drain to the bottom of the finger because now, you know, the blood pressure is gone, so the blood will drain and settle down at the bottom of the finger, which is down there. Well, there you have it. You see that black there?
That's all the
blood that drained down to the bottom of the finger and settled at the bottom of this giant finger and then turned to stone. Now, I can talk a lot more. I'm just giving you the very quick, you know, 2-minute introduction to this. I can speak volumes about the science, the chemistry, the metamorphic process, the transmutation, the fossilization, the petrification, which I must tell you is completely unknown. This is not something that you will learn in geology school or metallurgy school. They just don't know. It's not in those books at all. I had to go and discover this and study it and put the pieces of the puzzle together, what actually happens here. So just to finish the story about this finger, because I want to come back to the people that work in the metaphysics or spiritual fields, how to use the argument of probability. So now I'm saying this is a finger. This is a finger of a giant, right? It's about 50 times this, about 50 of my fingers will probably fit in there. It's a rough estimate. So this is 50 times larger than I am. So we're looking at about an 80-meter tall being, 80 meters. This is something unheard of, right? But so in the USA in 2019, just about a year ago now, almost a year ago, I was with a guy called John Vavenko, who's a remote viewer. And John teaches remote viewers around the world. I showed him the stone and he went, wow, that's amazing. Do you want me to remote view it for you? So I said, sure, please do. I'd love that. So he took a photograph of it, okay, a picture of a stone, just one picture. And he sent it off to, I believe it was about 12 people, 12 of his students around the world. And he said, please remote view this object. 24 hours later, all 12 people, or whatever the number was, came back with this story. Except they all said it was a severed toe of a giant. And the one person said it was either a finger, the front finger, like I said, or a toe of a very large being. So all 12 people came back. People that didn't communicate, they had no idea what they were looking at. It was a bloody rock. I mean, if I show you a picture of this, what are the statistical probabilities that you would come up with an idea that this stone is the severed toe of a giant? In an infinite possibility, you know what I mean? In a world of infinite possibilities of this, what this could be, all of them came back saying it was a toe of a giant. So the statistical probability argument says that's what it is. There's absolutely no question about it. So we are looking at a severed toe of a giant, about 80 meters tall. And they gave me a lot more information. Some of them went into remote viewing the circumstances around the death of this being and so forth. So I'm just giving you the skinny here. So when I tell people I have a museum filled with tools and artifacts that are ancient advanced technology and also fossils of creatures, beings, humanoids, and probably Anunnaki, I'm not exaggerating. And then when I say we have mountains covered with these fossilized body parts, I'm not exaggerating. They are everywhere.
Right now, we're not allowed to travel. But as soon as we're allowed to travel, where do we need to come, Michael? Tell us about your museum.
Well, the best is just go onto my website, either michaeltellinger.com and click under the tours or tourism, or go to stonecircletours.co.za. And you'll see all the different trips that we do. You can come on a full day trip, or you can come for a week. You can whatever. We put a package together for you based on your level of interest, and awesome. It includes the museum. You stay at the Stone Circle Lodge with us, and then we go up the mountain, and we go and explore, and we go look at Adam's calendar, and we go look at the giant footprint, And those that want to go across the border to Swaziland, we go there to look at the Ngwenya mine. So, you know, there's so much to see here. And the more we discover, the more mind-blowing it gets. And it literally shifts the time. It changes everything we think we knew about our human origins and what the world looked like in ancient times. It's a very different story.
Wonderful. We're coming. You better be ready for it. I want to ask you now a little bit about your work in Ubuntu and contributionism. And just as a way of introducing that, I have been thinking during these strange times of lockdown around the virus, people asking questions about how we live, what kind of globalization we want, what kind of globalization we don't want, whether our supply chains are too long, and reflecting a little bit about how we live on this planet. And it put me in mind of my grandparents. So just, I hope you're sitting comfortably, because I want to tell you about my grandma and grandpa. My grandpa was born in 1900. My grandma was born in 1911. They lived in Buckinghamshire, England. They were just outside a major town, but they were in farming country. And they lived in a little terrace of 16 semi-detached homes. I think it was 16. And they all had long strip gardens. And they made a lot of their own food. And so those strip gardens, they'd all have vegetable gardens. One of them had a little orchard. One of them had goats. One of them had chickens. One of the dads had wonderful mechanical engineering skills, so he was the go-to guy for all that sort of stuff. And the way they lived, it was not so much a barter economy as a sharing economy. And the way it would work is that a mum would say to a child, "I've got all these surplus eggs, take with you, see if your mum can use them. Or I've got a bunch of apples we're not going to use, see if your mum can use those." And that was a big part of how those families lived together. They were working people. They earned money. But they didn't use money for everything. Sharing life in that way and sharing resources was a big part of how they lived and prospered through some very testing decades. And I've been thinking about that and wondering if we need to discover our families and our neighbors in that kind of way again as we look at an uncertain future. Now, in your case, you've taken that idea and you've really run with it over the last 15 years, and you've developed the philosophy, the global movement of Ubuntu, and the philosophy of contributionism, and you've produced a working strategy that's fleshed out in the One Small Town strategy. And I'd love to hear you speaking into that, because I think there's a great appetite out there as people think in fresh ways about how do we live together and how do we live and prosper in these strange times.
Yeah, that's really the biggest story here, and that needs to be addressed more urgently than anything else. You know, having this study and exploring ancient civilizations is all wonderful and it's exciting and it's a great discovery, but if we wake up tomorrow morning and we don't really have a future, we find ourselves either enslaved by the corporate structure or the royal political elite, and we just become absolute slaves in a totalitarian state, that is not good. So we need to start seriously thinking about our future. I've been doing this for the last 20 years, and especially actively for the past 15 years when I launched the concept of contributionism and started to develop that model. What I found in my lectures around the world, which is quite staggering, when I do the Ubuntu lectures and workshops and the contributionism lectures and workshops, I always start by asking, how many of us are happy with the way the world is going? And I must tell you, no one has ever put up their hand. No way, ever, ever, never. So it clearly tells us, and I'm talking about sometimes large audiences, like in Germany, I asked this to an audience of about 3,000 people. Not one person put up their hand. There's always some joker that's, you know, joking, but it clearly tells us that people are desperately and deeply unhappy with what's going on in the world. And they're worried about their world, their families, the future. and what's happening around us. And right now, we cannot ask for a better time to contemplate and look inwards and contemplate our lives and what's actually going on. Do we want to go back to this broken world, a broken society that's a dog-eat-dog, where we have to work like slaves just to survive? Some people have to have two jobs and sometimes three jobs just to pay the rent, pay the bills, buy bread and milk so that you can keep your family and your children alive. Then there's the education system that's just fallen apart, that is shoving crap down our children's brains and throats, just indoctrination to create a future obedient labor force for the royal banking elite. And people are very rapidly waking up to this.
If you would like to hear Michael Tellinger go deeper into these and more controversial topics, go to fifthkind.tv for uncensored access to the full 2 hours of this revealing interview.